You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Hello, thank you for tuning in to the Health Justice Radio Collective. Today we're speaking with Mary Ellen Parker. She worked as a nurse in the Niagara region for over 30 years and was diagnosed with a rare condition called HHT, or hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia, in 2001. She spoke to us from her home in St. Catharines, Ontario. Hello, Mary Ellen. How are you today?
Hi, I'm good today, thanks. Having a really good day.
Great. Thank you for letting me interview you about your condition.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So do you mind telling us a little bit about your background?
Okay. I'm 60 years old. Okay. I've nursed for about 30 years before I was waylaid.
Yeah.
I have two sisters. I had a brother who passed away. My parents are gone.
Yeah.
I think of myself as a mom first, a nurse second.
Mm-hmm.
No, maybe a mom, a friend, and then a nurse. I had usual childhood illnesses, nothing. Yeah. I was a nosebleeder, had nosebleeds from the time I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
Always had nosebleeds. But other than that, I had an active, happy life. Okay. Married twice.
Wow.
Not good at it.
And in terms of where did you work when you were a nurse?
I started out in seniors' homes, in nursing homes. From there, I went to hospital. I was an RNA, now called an RPN for years. I went back to school in 76 and got my RNs and nursed for all those years happily.
Wow.
And a special at the end in pediatrics in the community.
Okay.
After I finished hospital nursing, I went to the community and loved it and ran a pediatric program. And it was wonderful.
Was it? Wow.
Yeah.
That's really great to hear. And so you were diagnosed with hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia.
Yes, I was.
It's a long name.
Yes, it is. It's a mouthful.
Yeah, and so when were you diagnosed with HHT?
Oh, the actual diagnosis happened around either 2000 or 2001.
Yeah.
And it was a big deal to me because I'd never heard of it.
And yeah, it's not a common condition.
No. Can I tell you what actually happened?
Yes, of course.
Okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to tell you, wanted to go to work one day, and I got up. I usually started my day by 7:30, 8 o'clock. I would be on the road to go see my patients. I had been up in the night with a terrible headache.
Mm-hmm.
I took some medication, went back to bed. When I got up, my first visit was to be at 8, and by quarter after 8, I was furious that I couldn't see well enough. Yeah. I just had spots in front of my eyes. I assumed it was a hypoglycemic reaction, which I'd had before. Felt quite similar, except that the headache was a little worse.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to work for the morning. Gave up eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Went to the doctor. They were sure I had a stroke at that point. They diagnosed the stroke without really doing anything except the eye exam.
Mm-hmm. This is where?
This was in St. Catharines.
Okay.
I was in St. Catharines. Okay. I went to see Dr. Bako, who's an ophthalmologist here.
Mm-hmm.
He diagnosed the stroke fairly quickly.
Yeah.
What did I want to say? Sorry.
Yeah, so he diagnosed a stroke.
He diagnosed a stroke, but he didn't really want to send me to a neurologist, which I argued and eventually did go to the neurologist.
Right.
My family doctor was away, and when he got back, he sent me to an internist because by that point, I had also found out that my hemoglobin was less than 60.
Okay. So something is happening.
I was having a hard time walking. I was bumping into things and veering and people were, I had to stop working at that point, even though I still didn't know what was going on with me.
Right.
And as a nurse, it was very confusing because I was told I had an embolic stroke.
Yeah.
And then I was told my hemoglobin was less than 60. So as a nurse, it was very confusing to know that I'd clotted and produced a stroke.
Yeah.
And was bleeding
somewhere
to the point where I could hardly get around.
Yeah.
And that's when he sent me to Dr. James Harrigan in Niagara Falls, who mentioned HHT, hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia. Said he had never seen it, but he had learned it as a med student, and suggested that I see if I could find a computer, which I didn't have at that point, and read up on it. And he seemed pretty sure that that was perhaps what I had.
Right.
But no explanation as to what, like, I didn't understand what that meant, why that would have anything to do with a stroke or a
bleed. Did he tell you anything more about
Not really. He said, you get spots, and I see dots on your lips, and that's how it presents often, is with little red dots. Typically, they're on your fingertips, your lips, your oral mucosa, toes often have them. Mine are very subtle and hard to see. I have them on my lower lip, on my tongue in a couple places. There's one on my nose. There's one on my hand.
They're not very many.
And I have met other people with the same condition since who have them everywhere. So I feel very lucky with that. As time went on, I tried to go back to school and had to drop out. I couldn't keep up. I still didn't know exactly why this bleeding kept happening and why I had to have blood transfusions.
So in terms of maybe telling our listeners a bit more about what HHT is,
okay,
because it is a rare condition. And not
yes,
people know about it.
I will talk about that. There's only one HHT. There's now two, but when I was diagnosed, there's one HHT center in Canada.
Okay.
Happened to be at St. Mike's Hospital in Toronto. Yeah. So already I'm feeling lucky.
Yeah.
But we went there, my family and I.
Yeah.
And she looked at me. It took her, I spent a day. She checked me. She set up a day for me to come in. We did blood tests. We did arterial blood draw. We did breathing tests. We did an MRI of my brain and my liver. We did an angiogram where they found the very large arteriovenous malformations in my liver.
So AVM, so arteriovenous
malformations
are basically your blood is going from arteries to veins
without
bypassing through capillaries.
That's right. And the problem, the biggest problem with that is if you have AVMs in your lungs, the blood is shunted right to left, so because of the pressure of the artery.
Right.
So instead of going to your lung to be filtered, which we know the lung does filter out little clots, you miss that step, and the blood goes directly to your brain or your heart, and thus the strokes. So that's how that happens. I had to learn all that, as we all do, but it's a very interesting disease. There's really no cure at this point, but I have blood transfusions when my hemoglobin drops too much. I go for iron infusions at least every 6 weeks to 3 months, basically. My AVMs happen to be large ones in my liver, in my lungs, in my GI tract, particularly around my liver with the GI tract. I had one in my brain. I did have brain surgery in 1998. As you can see, my lovely dent in the side of my head.
You see? It's not quite noticeable.
No, I try to.
Hairstyle.
Yeah, that's right. We try to cover that. But yeah, I'm aware of it. Nobody else, I'm sure nobody else notices it really, but I know I've got a big dent in the side of my head. So
HHT is a hereditary condition.
It's hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia, and that is exactly what it is. You're missing capillaries. Mm-hmm. That is the problem, and in specific areas, as I've already mentioned.
So you could bleed.
Bleed easily. They're like a little aneurysm, which is in fact what they diagnosed my brain one is. We're pretty sure it was an AVM from HHT, but when I got it treated, I wasn't diagnosed, and so it was clipped as regular aneurysm.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which and is that, scary and dangerous, right?
It was very frightening. Yeah. And it was after that that the vomiting started.
Okay.
When I eat, and I do eat, I used to eat a lot more,
but
I can't keep it down. That is apparently from the large AVMs in my liver. The blood is stolen by the liver from the large bowel.
Mm-hmm.
And with the large AVMs, you've got a need for extra blood. So my heart's having to pump extra hard.
Yeah.
I now have an enlarged heart.
You do?
Okay. Yes. I also have a murmur. We're not quite sure. It's never been an issue, so I'm sure it's not anything serious.
Okay.
But I'm very aware of, I have to watch for congestive heart failure because of all this extra blood being pumped in my body.
So how does the vomit happen?
I eat and within, I would say, 3 minutes to 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It just fires back up. It just comes flying out. Yeah. Sometimes it's very, what's the word I want?
Projectile.
Thank you. Yeah. Other times it's not. Other times it just seems to come up and come out.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really control it. Yeah. We tried every type of medication, IV. I still can't keep medication down orally very well. I do take it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much good it does me.
Yeah. So what do you do in terms of food?
I eat.
Okay.
I have been told I should eat whatever I want, which used to be lots of fun.
Yeah.
As the years goes on, one gets tired of vomiting.
Yeah.
And now I have developed nausea in the last year and a half, which I didn't used to have. It used to be very mechanical, just went down and came back. Yeah. Now I experience nausea with it, which has made it more difficult.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah. And so in terms of your nutrition, how are you making sure you're getting, you know, all the things that you need into your body?
That's right. It's a big concern to get all of the nutrition. So since 2001, I believe, I have had a central line. I have a Portacath most of the time, which I access once a week and de-access on Fridays. I run total parenteral nutrition 4 nights a week. They believe that I keep down about a third of what I eat.
Okay.
So the TPM provides the other two-thirds. I choose to take Saturday, Sunday, and Monday off.
Yeah.
So I don't do it those days. But that may change.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, there is no cure, but there is a new medication. Can I speak about that?
Of course.
There's a new cancer drug. It's called Avastin, or I'm just going to go with Avastin.
Okay.
Bevacizumab, I believe.
Bevacizumab. Okay.
Bevacizumab or something like that. It's a boom of food to me. But in any case, it has people with large liver AVMs and nosebleeds.
Mm-hmm.
It has shown a great propensity for getting rid It won't get rid of the AVMs, but it stops new vessels from growing. So you're not going to get rid of the ones you already have, but new vessels can't grow.
Right.
So in cancer, it stops the vessels from feeding the tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's used in cancer, interestingly, they often do have nosebleeds and GI bleeds.
Okay.
But when used in people with HHT, it stops the nosebleeds.
Interesting.
And there are four or five people throughout the States and Canada who have had large liver AVMs, AVMs and were to have liver transplants who have now come off the liver transplant list
because
this drug has helped them so much. So I'm very hopeful. We're going to try to do some fundraising, and I have both St. Mike's and my TPN people in Hamilton at McMaster.
Yeah.
Helping me to find funding to get this done, and my family is going to try and organize a fundraiser.
What's the cost like for this drug?
The cost for this drug is approximately $7,500 a month.
A month?
Yes.
Wow.
So there's no way.
Yeah, and it's a long-term thing. You're not teaching it a few months. It's for.
Yeah, I would need it at least for 3 months.
Okay.
And then we're not sure, but I would give anything to have that opportunity.
Yeah. So. It would really help with quality of life, right?
Yes. Because right absolutely. Now, yeah. I eat and I throw up. It's not very inviting.
So in terms of your nursing career, then, what happened?
Yes. I had
you were diagnosed?
I tried, as I said, to go back to school and continue on with my nursing, but I was too tired and exhausted, and my brain just wouldn't help me out enough because of the difference in the blood flow, and I found I had to stop nursing.
Yeah.
So I've been on long-term disability now since 2000.
Yeah. And how was that for you?
Well, I'm okay with it now.
Yeah.
It's very hard. I when you look at it, I lost my job. Yeah. I lost my ability to drive. I lost too much peripheral vision to continue driving a car.
Okay.
So I can no longer drive. I can no longer work. I found it very, very difficult. I find it very difficult to be dependent on people to get where I have to go.
Yeah.
I moved close to the bus depot here downtown so that I can take buses to get where I need to go in the city. But my family and my support system, my friends are amazing to get me to all of my appointments.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of work, HHT. You have to do blood work routinely.
Yeah.
You have to run the IV. You have to go for blood transfusion. Because I have a central line, I have to deal with line infections, which are
super scary,
horrific,
and
frightening. Yeah. And you're so septic that you just want to die when it happens. Goodness. Feels terrible. My whole body feels like somebody's been beating it all night.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a terrible feeling. But
you're really
do my best.
Doing well.
I'm doing great.
Yeah.
I'm doing great. I'm very lucky. I don't know where I'd be without my family, friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even my nurse cohorts, it's wonderful to still have them around.
Being a nurse for all these years, you were taking care of people who were dependent on you and who were needing other people to take care of them. How does it feel and to be?
It feels wrong. You're on the other side of the table.
Yeah.
So used to giving the care, so used to listening, and so used to trying to be there for everything you can be.
Yeah.
I find it distressing to be on the other side. I need to have nurses come in. It's much better. I have a portacath now, which allows me to access and look after my own IV. The difference is that when you're no longer the one giving the care, but receiving the care, it's frightening. You learn as a nurse, and I'm sure as a doctor, that your own germs are okay.
Yeah.
You can look after your own germs. But when someone else is looking after you, you're prone to their germs.
Yeah. If they're not careful.
If they're not careful, right.
Yeah.
Masks are great, but not the be-all, end-all. I find that now that I have learned about my disease and about how to look after my my central line, I really don't allow anyone else to touch my central line unless it's a student. I'm open to students. I'm very open to that. I know that's the only way we're going to learn. Otherwise, I do all of my own care. I do have a nurse who comes in to help me out with my supplies, and he checks my port to make sure it looks all right and that sort of thing. But
The control is gone. Yeah.
So well, you look for things to control, and I'm sure that's also part of why I need to look after my own port.
Is that something
I can control it?
Yeah.
I lost control of eating.
Yeah.
Because although I eat what I want, when I want, as I was instructed to, I can't keep it down.
Yeah. you're controlling what you eat, but it's not staying.
So it's very different to be on the patient side of the fence and explaining, and instead of listening, talking
and trying to be
and
heard,
talking, definitely trying to be heard. I find that community awareness has become what I really need to concentrate on for this. People, it's a big name, hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia. People are afraid of it.
Yeah, sounds scary.
Including doctors.
Yeah.
If they're not aware of the disease, if they're not comfortable with the disease, they really don't want to see me.
Mm-hmm.
I had to have surgery in St. Catharines earlier this year, and 5 cardiologists refused to see me. Because they didn't know my disease. There were different excuses, but...
Yeah.
The main thing was that they're frightened of my disease.
Yeah.
It used to be 1 in 100,000, I believe, is what they thought HHT was. And now it's 1 in 5,000 to 1 in 10,000 is what I understand.
Yeah.
A doctor apparently sees in a family practice about 3,000 patients a year.
Really?
So they may see one. They may see none.
Right.
They very often, mostly, don't ever see this disease.
And it maybe they do see it. They don't know
exactly.
That it is.
Exactly. You know. I am fortunate in that I did hook up through the computer with the HHT organization.
Mm-hmm.
They have been amazing to me. Dr. Marie Fonin is the best thing ever at St. Mike's in Toronto. I found HHT on the computer, and I asked them, what are AVMs? I don't understand. I think I may have, they thought, when I had transesophageal echo done here in St. Catharines when I was, before I was diagnosed, they were pretty sure I had a Peyton Freeman O'Valley. Occult. Peyton Freeman O'Valley. They couldn't find it, but they were sure that was it because of the right to left shunting.
Yeah.
I went for an angiogram to get that fixed, and lo and behold, there was no occult Freeman O'Valley.
So they figured out maybe it was the AVM that was shunting.
Well, they didn't really figure that out, actually. They didn't.
They just didn't know what happened.
No, they really didn't know.
So what did they do? They left it
as is? They just left it. They had to leave it as is.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a while to learn, but as we know now, with the shunting from the arterial to the vein, this is what, if you have lung AVMs, this is what causes the strokes.
Okay.
The blood is shunted straight to your brain instead
of
going
to
the lung to be filtered. Right,
yeah.
There's no capillaries.
When you were diagnosed, the doctor who did mention that maybe you have HHT, he said, I studied this in med school. And
yes, I heard of it in med school.
Yeah.
Heard
and
of
that
it.
Was about it. And
that
so you went
voted.
on your own time.
Yes.
And looked up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the HHT organization was wonderful. Eventually, the communications person called the doctor for me. She saw me. She talked to me for an hour. She saw me, set up an appointment.
Mm-hmm.
You spend a day doing a brain MRI, a bubble test to find out if, in fact, there are AVMs in your lung.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of blood work. Most of us are anemic. Because we have been bleeding and no one's been aware.
Yeah.
Nosebleeds, again, are the big thing. I have pretty much stopped the nosebleeds.
Yeah.
I had many after my... interestingly, it is attached somewhat to hormones also.
Really?
As a teenager and a young lady, I had nosebleeds with my periods every time.
Really?
And I laughed and said, I just have too much blood. My body's just trying to get rid of it. I tend to be a happy girl. So it was no big deal. I'd always had them.
Mm-hmm.
When I was pregnant, I had terrible nosebleeds. After the birth of my second child, the nosebleeds kind of stopped. I now have an occasional nosebleed, but with HHT, nosebleeds are so big.
That's the most common thing.
Really, and people, I met people, I went to an HHT conference after I was first diagnosed, happened to be in Toronto.
Wow.
I was lucky again.
Yeah.
And I went and found out so much information by going there, but there is so much that we're not aware of still with HHT. There's there's people out there with it who are having horrible problems and nobody knows why.
So, you know, going through the system after all these years with a rare condition, what were some of the best and the worst experiences you've had along the way?
The worst experiences are, as I've mentioned, people won't have anything to do with you. A good thing is that I look healthy. Mm-hmm. A bad thing is that I look healthy. difficult to get diagnosed when you look well. When I was diagnosed, my hemoglobin was less than 60. I had had at least one stroke. Inevitably, I'd had two strokes, that one I wasn't even aware of.
Really?
That would be the one that probably affected my memory the most. That was a left frontal stroke. The other one was an occipital stroke, which affected my peripheral vision, mm-hmm. which has stopped me from being able to drive. I'm dependent for care as well as transportation and many other things. I find that very difficult. I'm used to be the one driving people places. I'm used to being the one that looks after people. So it's a very large turnaround in my life. And
But you look healthy.
Thank you. I do. And like I said, most of the time that's wonderful and thank you. But when you're trying to find out what's wrong with you and you look healthy,
it's not people easy. Don't Maybe it's a lesson for listen. Doctors and future doctors to, you know, even though someone may look okay, to be careful of the details.
And the neurologist told me it was a very rare disease and I certainly didn't have it. And that needs not to happen.
Yeah.
Because it's rare doesn't mean it's not out there.
It happens.
It does happen.
It does happen. Any last words, lessons to be learned for future doctors and doctors who are listening?
Listen.
Community members.
Listen and listen closely.
Yeah.
Look, hear what they're saying. Don't just listen, but really hear. Yeah. Hear what they're saying, because I tried to tell people all along that something was wrong, that I just wasn't right. I didn't feel right, and I couldn't get anywhere.
Yeah.
So I would say listening is the very biggest thing we have to do.
Mm-hmm. Listen and be present, right?
Be present. Absolutely. Yeah.
And take someone seriously and not let them off.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Mary Ellen, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope this is helpful. I just hope that everyone has learned a little something from me and it will help you with your studies and learning. Yeah.
I think there are some important lessons that we really learn from you. Especially listen to your patients.
Yes.
You know, take the time.
It's very big.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Okay.
Hope
Best
it was
of
helpful.
Luck.
Thank you very
it certainly
much.
Certainly was.
And that was our interview today with Mary Ellen Parker. If you'd like to reach her or access more information about HHT, please check out our blog at healthjusticeradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Because you came to me with naught save love, and hold my hand and lift my eyes above. A wider world of hope and joy I see. Speak to me in accents sweet. I find the roses waking around my feet, and I am led through tears and joy to thee.